Today's Teisho is case 31 in the Blue Rock Collection. Meiyoku comes to Shoken. Engo's introduction. With subconscious stirring, images appear. With awareness, ice forms. If there is no stirring and no awareness, you have not escaped from the confinement of the fox's hole. If you truly penetrate in your practice and become the master of it, you will experience not a trace of obstruction. You will be like a dragon supported by deep waters, like a tiger that commands its mountain retreat. Then, if you let go, even tiles and pebbles become illuminating. If you hold fast, even pure gold will lose its luster. The koans of the old masters will become tedious. Tell me, what am I talking about? See the following. Main subject. Meiyoku came to Shokei carrying his bell staff with him, walked around Shokei's seat 3 times, took his staff, ringing the bells, stuck it in the ground, and stood up straight. Shokei said, "Good." Meiyoku then came to Nansen, walked around Nansen's seat, shook his staff, ringing the bells, stuck it in the ground, and stood up straight. Nansen said, "That's not the answer." Meiyoku said, "But Shokei said, 'Good.' Why do you say that's not the answer?" Nansen said, "Shokei is good, but you don't have the answer. You are blown about by the wind." Secho's verse. This mistake, that mistake, never take them away. In the four seas, the waves subside. 100 rivers flow quietly to the sea. The 12 bells of the staff tinkled up high. Empty and silent is the road to the gate. No, not empty and silent. The enlightened person must take medicine for the illness of having no illness. This is a koan that involves 2 Dharma brothers. Meiyoku came to Shokei. Meiyoku and Shokei are roughly contemporaries. In fact, Meiyoku, Shokei, and Nansen are all Dharma brothers. They were all students of the great master Matsu, ancestor horse. Okay? So Matsu was a great Zen teacher and produced many deeply awakened students, and these are 3 of them. So this little story involves these 3 Dharma brothers. Main subject. Meiyoku came to Shokei carrying his bell staff with him. Now in China, people who went on a pilgrimage sometimes carried a staff. This has probably disappeared in China. It's true in Japan today, where people go on pilgrimages, they carry a staff. Often the staff has 3 prongs, and there's a circle on top of there's like a halo on the top, and there's little bells hanging off it. This is like a pilgrim's staff. This actually goes back to ancient India. Where you will sometimes see people carrying a staff with 3 points. Trident. The trident is an ancient symbol in Europe as well as in India and also in Asia. So basically this is a pilgrim's staff. And Meiyoku came to Shokei carrying his pilgrim's staff. He comes to Shokei's temple. He walks around Shokei's seat 3 times, took his staff, shook it so that the bells jingled, stuck it in the ground, and stood up straight. And Shokei looks at him. Shokei's sitting on his cushion. So you can imagine this. This pilgrim is traveling through the temples of his Dharma brothers. And why is he traveling? Because he's just had Daikensho. So he's just had Daikensho, and he has totally experienced with every atom of his being a Buddha nature. Right? This is a Daikensho experience, deep, pure Daikensho. So he's finished this experience, and it can be a very powerful experience. You can laugh for days, you can cry for days. For a long time after your Daikensho, it is like being in the Arctic summer, where the sun never sets. It's an unbelievable, wonderful experience. So he's in the Arctic summer, where the sun never sets, and walking on top of the world, you know. And so he goes to see his Dharma brothers, Nansen and Shokei. So he's got his pilgrim staff, he heads off and he gets to Shokei's temple, and he goes in and Shokei's sitting in the Dharma hall, sitting in the Chan hall, meditating. And Myoku comes up with his staff and walks around the cushion, sticks it in the ground, and stands up straight, and Shokei looks at him and says, "Good! Good!" Because he says, "Well, you know, see you later." So then he leaves. He goes over to Nansen's temple, Nanchuan's temple. And he comes into the temple, Nanchuan's sitting doing his zazen, Myoku circles the sitter, puts the staff on the ground, boom, you know, jingle, 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 boom. And then Nansen looks up and says, "I'm sorry, but that's not the answer." And Myoku says, "But, you know," he says, but Shokei said it was a good answer, you know. He says, "Well, Shokei says everything." He says, "It's Shokei's nature to say yes to everything. Everything is good to Shokei, but you haven't got the answer." You know, this is such an important koan, such an important koan. I would like to, this talk is about the value of what we might call holy, sacred failure. You know, let us praise failure, please. And let us understand that failure is holy and the most wonderful thing in the world. Let us have no misconceptions about this. You know, I went through many sesshins like this. I was working on the Mu Koan. I was desperate. I dreamed of answering the Mu Koan. I would go to sesshin, and for the first so many years of Zen practice, you know, it's very strenuous. You know, I would go to sesshin. You know, day one, and my legs would be okay. I'd be thinking, okay, maybe this is it. You know, maybe those days are behind me now. You know, and day two. Damn, you know, my legs are starting to hurt, you know, really starting to hurt. And I used to always get sick at sesshin. I would often get like a cold fever blister, you know, a cold sores on my lips. After a while, I would just always put in my pack, in my grip, you know, my shaving kit, like a cold sore medicine, you know, because I just always got cold sores. I always felt totally wiped out by sesshin. And so I would, you know, day three, be just hanging on, very tired. Day four, you know, no answer. Day five, no answer, you know. And this went on for years. And one day, I answered the Mu Koan, so to speak. We say answered, it's really not possible. I had a deep encounter with the Mu, with Mu. And it was a totally unselfconscious thing, you know. I had been going to so many sesshins that I had given up almost on the possibility of ever answering this thing. I was just sitting. It was like, I don't even know why I'm sitting anymore. I'm just sitting, you know. And really, I mean, I was just sitting, you know. I guess I just stayed in the Zen group because I don't know why, you know, actually, you know, I really don't. And I mean, my friends were there, you know, we all trained at the temple, but the idea of answering this koan has become so remote. And, you know, sometimes I would go in to see Genki Roshi, and I would just, you know, I would go in, I would sit there in the Dokusan line, and I would hear, whoa, whoa, you know, and I would get in there and I couldn't open my mouth. I just couldn't. And Genki was practically going, come on, you know, give it a try, you know. It's like, I just couldn't. It was like, I can't, you know. My spirit was crushed, you know. So I would just, you know, I remember one session, you know, where he was practically, you know, he's like, come on, you know, just give it a try, you know. No, this is pointless, you know. And so I didn't say that. I just couldn't do anything, you know. So I was paralyzed. And, you know, so, you know, basically, we would, you know, when those sesshins were many sesshins, and I would pack, you know, at the end of the, get to come to the sesshin, unpack my stuff, you know. At first I would think, okay, I'm going to have enlightenment. You know, and then, you know, as the years went by, I thought, well, maybe I'll answer my koan, you know. As the years went by, I thought, I don't even care if I answer my koan, you know. I don't know why I'm doing this. I just unpack my stuff, go to session, pack at the end, pack up all my stuff, you know, and goodbye, you know. And this went on for years, you know. And, you know, for me, working on the Mu Koan was just like a journey into confusion, because I started Zen practice knowing what I wanted to do, which was to achieve enlightenment. And the more I went on, I became increasingly clueless, you know. And the strange thing is that after I had totally given up, you know, like totally given up, and I was just sort of going to sesshin, I had a deep encounter with Mu. And I remember, this was when we were building our temple up in the mountains, and I was staying that summer for a couple months. We were building the temple, and I had volunteered to just go up there and work. And then we had a sesshin at the end of the months of work, and I just got up from my cushion. And I went into the teacher and presented my Mu. And I don't, you know, it was just totally unselfconscious act. You know, it was just like the consequences didn't matter. It was just totally unselfconscious. And it really surprised me. You know, it was really a shocker because, you know, what came out of my mouth wasn't from me, you know. And it was a shock, you know. And so, you know, after the Mu Koan, I thought, well, you know, first of all, right after that, I was just sort of like dazed for a while. That koan, that session ended. And then I went home and I sort of reflected on it all. But, oh my God, I've actually answered a koan, you know. This is amazing. I knew those 7 years of training would pay off, you know. It's like, oh my God, I've actually answered the Mu Koan, you know, that's fantastic. So I thought, you know, after answering the Mu Koan, that, you know, Genki, you know, in the Mumonkan, it says that after you've answered the Mu Koan, your eyebrows will be interwoven with the eyebrows of the Buddhas and the patriarchs, you know, so that you'll see them eyeball to eyeball. And actually, this is true. When you enter deep Mu Shin, you are seeing with Buddha's eyes. This is a Buddha's eye view of the world. You know, when you look into deep Mu Shin, yeah, and then you become one with Mu Shin, and so-called finish the Mu Koan, you are seeing the you can see the world with Buddha's eyes. You know, this is absolutely true. When the big mind enters your body, this is your the moment you become one with the Buddhas and the patriarchs. That's true. You know. But then the strange, you know, so I didn't really appreciate what had happened to me then, but I just knew I was very glad to have answered the koan. And I thought, well, gee, you know, now it's going to be down, all downhill from here. Mm-hmm. You know, it's going to be easy. It's going to be, you know, because everybody said this is the tough koan, you know. So then, basically, I got my next koan. And the strange thing was that I couldn't answer it, you know. And it was like, oh no, I'm, you know, it was all a dream. I never really answered any koans. I'm still stuck in the same place, you know. Oh well, you know, it really, it was like, I can't believe this is happening again, right? You know, I'm not answering this koan either, you know. And I did think at the time, I mean, it actually made me mad, you know. I felt like this Zen is a big ripoff, you know. Really, I actually did. I thought, what a scam, you know. I was really mad. There was one session where I just thought, what? Really, I just kept thinking, this is just a rip-off, you know. I thought, and I couldn't answer the koan, you know. And meanwhile, it was the classic situation in our sangha, you know. Everybody was going into the Dokusan room, and clearly, you know, they'd be in there for an hour talking to the Roshi, and they'd come out. It was like, oh, they answered another one, you know, this sort of thing. And it was like, you know, I can't believe I can't answer this koan. But this is really a wonderful thing, actually, because I was stuck. You know, there was something I wasn't seeing. And, you know, it's just as I said yesterday, you know, when your true self, your big mind, has come through the wall and possessed your body for the first time, you are indeed seeing with Buddha's eyes. But you don't know how to use Buddha's eyes yet, see? It's like you've been blind all your life, and now you can see, but you don't know how to see. It's like those people who have been blind and they've been surgically rescued from blindness. But when they look around, they don't see the world of forms and shapes with depth and color. They don't know what they see yet. They have to learn. They have the capacity to see now, but they have to learn to see. And this is a big confusion for people, or at least it was a huge confusion for me, because I thought, well, if I'm, you know, if my eyebrows are interwoven with the Buddhas and the patriarchs, how come I can't answer this darn koan? But, you know, nobody really explained it to me, because that wasn't that wasn't in the cards. Genki, Roshi, and Webb never explained anything. You know, so that's their style. They liked to see people struggle with uncertainty, you know. And we did. And it's good to struggle with uncertainty, right? But, you know, a little help is not a bad idea. So the thing is, this is inevitably going to happen. First of all, it's inevitably the case that you're going to come to many sessions where you do not answer your koan. And this is a great opportunity to live a bigger life. And it's very important to realize that there's no timetable, and that some people develop slowly and some people develop quickly, and it's not in your control, and it doesn't matter ultimately, you know. The greatest Zen teacher of the 20th century was not a Japanese person. I love the Japanese, but they're always saying, so-and-so was the greatest Zen master, some Japanese guy was the greatest Zen master of the... Don't you believe it. You know, the greatest Zen master of the 20th century was a Chinese man named Xu Yun. And I, as I was mentioning the other day, Xu Yun Xu Yun was the son of an administrator in China, a minor military officer and administrator. And his father did not want him to become a practitioner of Chan. So he married him when he was still a child to two young ladies. And they were all rather unusual people because actually they all began to practice Zen. And as soon as Xu Yun's father was dead, they all left their home and went to various temples in China. And they all achieved a Daikensho, as a matter of fact, quite unusual. And they carried on, they never lived as husband and wives. They carried on a correspondence for many years, however. But the point is, Xu Yun started practicing when he was about 18, after his dad died. And then he did Sesshin, many Sesshin, year after year. You know, in Japan, actually, people do 6 or 7 Sesshin a year. In China, that may have been the case too, actually, before the revolution. Xu Yun lived much of his life as a solitary practitioner, but he would always come out of the mountains to do Sesshin. And he did Sesshin maybe 5, 6, 7 Sesshin a year for many years. You know, like he was in his 50s before he had his Daikensho. So, you know, everybody who knew Xu Yun said that he was really a tremendously inspirational person. You know, people said that it was like meeting one of the great Zen masters of old times. You know, that once in every 500 years there's a person who can practice like that, whose insight is so penetrating and so on. But Xu Yun took 40 years to mature. And when he did mature, you know, it was really something. So it's very important to realize that the clock is not running. And that this is between you and the universe, right? This is between you and the universe. So it just depends on whether whether you can find in yourself a patience and humility to walk this path. And not worry about success or failure. And, you know, for me, this was very hard. You know, when I started doing Zen, I was so impatient for breakthroughs, yeah? I wanted to have mystical experiences, so-called. And, I was just determined to have an unusual and exciting experience. But, you know, they didn't come. I just sat on the cushion and tried to think great thoughts and so on. And I tried to impress my teacher. And, as I said, session after session, year after year, I was unable even to answer the breath perception koan, even to focus wholeheartedly and open-heartedly on my breath. So eventually I was appointed tenzo, or cook, for the Sangha. You know, in our Sangha we would have sesshins that were a little bit bigger than this, maybe 35 or 40 people. And our system was that one person each half year would be picked by the roshi, a teacher, to cook for two sesshins and do very little practice, just devote himself or herself single-mindedly to preparing the food. So this was not a job that I wanted to have, because I wanted to be, I wanted to be enlightened. And I thought, well, you're not going to get enlightened, in the kitchen. That was too humble for me, And, I was kind of disappointed, because I would go, by the way, I was very, in those days, I got to be a very good sitter. You know, I could sit full lotus, sit after sit, and I could sit for, till the cows came home. But the truth is, I wasn't answering my koan. And I was determined to break through somehow. And then Genki Roshi said to me, well, I'd like you to be the cook. And of course, when he called me in, I thought he was going to, say, I'd like you to, lead the temple. I'd like you to... You're really enlightened already, You just don't know it. But I knew that wasn't true. But I was disappointed when he said, and in honor of your diligent practice, you're the cook. I became the cook. And the interesting thing was that I started being a cook with some resentment, but I discovered that, cooking is a wonderful thing, because you can give people a pleasure and help them. And I didn't realize how much I loved the people I practiced with until I had the opportunity to cook for them. And I didn't think this through, It wasn't like I sat down and thought those thoughts as I just said them. But I began to get interested in cooking, and I began to enjoy seeing people enjoy their food, And so I really became like a super cook, I wasn't trying to outdo anybody, but I just really got into cooking good food, And I had worked in a couple of restaurants when I was growing up, and I made different foods and made sauces. I made béarnaise sauce, these sauces are actually not very good for you, so I don't make them anymore. And they're not vegan; they're loaded with butter and milk and things like that. I just really, without even thinking about it, I really began to enjoy helping my fellow Sangha members by being a good cook. And I never consciously noticed this, but I really did throw myself into it, and I really would enjoy seeing their faces. So one of the things I used to do was make bread. I learned how to make bread. And I made these little rolls, I was just cooking, So I would be in there, I'd make some rolls, and everybody would come out at the end of the evening at 10:30, and I had a little basket of rolls for everybody, And I enjoyed, so I had a little jar of honey and a little basket of rolls. And everybody, and it was so pleasing to see everybody. I would go back and look to see if there were any rolls left. And if they were left, I was disappointed, Maybe I didn't make them good enough, at the end of the session, at the end of my period as a cook, Genki Roshi called me in and he said, you've never passed the breath koan, but I'm going to pass you anyway. Because you've finally done something that was a little less selfish. And I was very moved by that. And he wasn't scolding me, because the truth of it was so obvious, The point I'm trying to make is that the experience of failure was very good for me. And fortunately, I've had a lot of failures, But that's good. That's good, When they were digging up the ruins of Nalanda University, the first university in the world was built in India, The British don't tell anybody about this, but it's the first university in the world was built in India. It was Nalanda University, International University, and it admitted women as well as men. There were women's dorms as well as men's dorms at Nalanda University. This is a matter of historical fact. And people came from all over the world, from Indonesia, from China. They came even from, they think, from Europe to study at Nalanda University. And it was eventually destroyed by an invading army. In the ruins they found a little statue, like a plaque, and it shows the Buddha. And the inscription under it in Pali is, or it might actually be in Sanskrit, it says, seeing emptiness, he feels compassion. Yeah? Seeing emptiness, he feels compassion. So in the presence of Mu Xin, eventually what arises spontaneously in our hearts is compassion, a boundless compassion. This is a great, it's a wonderful thing, you know, amazing. This is the heart of Buddhism. But, you know, you could change it a little bit and say, seeing failure, he feels compassion. You know, the experience of failure is the most, I think, the most wonderful gift in the world. Because, we can hate it, and we can get angry, or we can be upset about it, and we can beat up on ourselves, etc. But at some point, strangely, we wind up loving the world more deeply, you know. This is amazing fact, you know. So you could say, seeing failure, he feels compassion, feels love. You know, so there's something about this experience of failure which is so important and which helps us so much, that it's just this great blessing. You know, and in the case of Myoku, he's had Daikensho, so this is just not like solving the Mukon. This is like the big deal, right? And he thinks, this is it! I'm Buddha now, you know? And, he's going to go, naturally, he wants to share this with his friends, whom he's practiced with for many years, so he goes to see Shokei, and Shokei just says, man, that's wonderful. Right? But that's because Shokei says, man, that's wonderful to everything. You know, that's Shokei's heart, right? He's failed enough. He's always, you know, always failing. So always deep compassion. And then he goes to see Nanchuan, a teacher of Joshu. This is a young Nanchuan, but Nanchuan's a little older, though, than Myoku. Myoku's the junior brother in this group. And Nanchuan sees him and says, wait a minute, you know, if you don't understand, you know, Daikensho doesn't mean you have nothing left to learn, right? Your only chance of growing is to continue to fail. And your only chance to grow is to continue to fail. After you have Daikensho, there's still many things to learn. In fact, actually, learning goes on forever because the possibilities for failure go on forever. And this is such a wonderful thing. You know, that, basically, after Daikensho, you still have a personal history. You still have karma. You have to clean up. So, you know, after Daikensho, you still have personality habits which are not enlightened. So you still might be impatient, you still might be a little fearful. So the rest of your life is cleaning up your karma, these aspects of your personality that come from growing up, and you know, you have to work on those. So still something to learn. And really great people don't sit in the temple, enjoying their enlightenment. If they do that, their enlightenment begins to decay. believe it or not. Their light begins to grow dim. You need to encounter the universe over and over again in its all of its painful difficulty, and generally that means helping people, you know, who haven't had this wonderful experience yet. So so Nansen's doing a tremendous favor to his younger brother. He's saying, wait a minute, you know, you've forgotten how you got here. It was failure that brought you here, and it's failure that will take you farther down the road, you know. So I just wanted to say today, you know, it's so important to understand holy failure, sacred failure. You know, that if you practice Zen, you're going to fail and fail and fail and fail. And this is the most wonderful thing in the world. You know, it's easy, everybody, you know, there's a saying in Zen, you know, that Linji used to say. He said, everybody wants to talk about the thoroughbreds, but nobody wants to talk about the sweating horses. In other words, we all like to see the beautiful racehorse come across the line, but think of all the horses who had to, you know, who draw wagons, and you know, a lot of Zen practice is just being a sweaty horse, you know, sitting on the cushion and sweating bullets, right? We all want to think about that moment where it's like, and now it's yours, you know, enlightenment, you know, here it is. And yes, thank you. I've wanted this for so many years, you know. Nobody wants to think about all the times on the cushion where you're just going, ring the bell. One of my friends used to say, you've never known what Zen, and you know, if you do Zen practice, one of the things you always learn to do is to go to the bathroom before you have to come to sit. And one of my friends said, you never know what, he said to somebody, this was one of my Dharma friends from Seattle. We were at a party and somebody was saying, oh, you two are Zen monks, you know. So, and I said, tell me about it. And my friend said, you'll never know what Zen is until you felt the pee going out drop by drop. He meant waiting for the bell to ring, right? Please ring the bell. You know? So, you know, let's understand the value of, you know, as I mentioned yesterday, you know, they take the bandages off the person's eyes and they say, now you see. But for a long time, you have to learn how to see. You know, there's a picture of an apple and an apple. They look identical. And you can sit there and say, damn it, I'm trying, you know. All of a sudden, you know, there's going to be this shift. It's like all of a sudden you can see it, you know. And there's no sense blaming yourself. There's no sense getting mad. You know, there's no sense. This is a wonderful opportunity to develop the new eyes, you know, to develop a new experience of the universe. So don't allow yourself ever to be disappointed when you don't answer your koan. That's really a great tragedy when somebody feels that way. I didn't answer you. I went to Sesshin and I didn't answer my koan. You think, oh, how wonderful. How wonderful that is. You know, really and truly. You know, the people who are really, who really practice Zen are not the people who, you know, year one answered 3 koans. Year two answered 10 koans. That would be really tragic. It's the experience of being stuck that forces us to grow and develop and to change and to become to enter bigger mind. This is another aspect of sitting in front of the wall. So, you know, you sit in front of the wall and you just have to change until the wall opens up. And that requires patience and humility. And also it requires kindness to yourself. Now, we live in a culture where everybody's tested, right? This is like the examination culture. So, you know, if you don't get an A, you feel like a failure, you know. Especially, you know, people who go to get advanced degrees are very good at passing tests. So, you know, if you start failing in your Zen practice, you come into this, you know, teacher, and the teacher says, that's not it, you know, not yet. You know, you can go home and think, oh my God, this is disaster. You know, it would be like having somebody say, well, you've written 400 pages, but we're going to have to reject this dissertation. You know? If that happens to you, you say, well, okay, I'll write a new dissertation. You know, really. Actually, I studied with a guy whose name was Benjamin Bennett, Ben Bennett. And he actually wrote a dissertation. He's a European literature scholar. He wrote a dissertation, and at the end of the whole thing, his whole committee was ready to pass it. And he actually withdrew it and just told him he thought it was junk, and wrote a new dissertation, you know. He's really something, you know. But, you know, the interesting thing was, you know, in his field, he's the best, you know. And he was willing to admit failure and go back to square one, you know. And that's why he's the best at what he is, you know. So, anyway, if you practice Zen, you're going to have a lot of days where you don't answer your koan. And you're going to have a lot of sesshin where you leave with aching legs and no answer to your koan. But that really and truly, this is living Zen. This not knowing is the essence of growth, essence of life. So please don't permit yourself to be discouraged or disappointed. And this is the most wonderful thing. This is holy failure. Another way to put it is, if you don't care about success or failure, even tiles and pebbles will become illuminating. See, that's Engo says, if you don't care about success or failure, everything becomes Buddha. Right? But if you're interested in succeeding, then even gold becomes valueless. See, even gold becomes valueless. And the koans of the old masters will become tedious. Secho's verse, this mistake, that mistake, never take them away. See, holy failure. In the four seas, the waves subside. 100 rivers flow quietly to the sea. See, all rivers lead to Buddha. See, all rivers lead to the sea. You can't go wrong. So failure is also encountering Buddha. It's just you have to learn this way to Buddha. See? The 12 bells of the staff tinkled up high. Empty and silent is the road to the gate. See? Empty and silent is the road to the gate. No, not empty and silent. I changed my mind. I see another aspect, see? The enlightened man must take medicine for the illness of having no illness. If there's no chance of failure, you're lost. It's hopeless. So needing medicine being sick is the best of health. You know, always, it never ends. You know, there's always another dimension to reality. Zen practice is an infinite practice. You know, every day I get up and I sit on the cushion, and it's wonderful and exciting and actually always something new. I swear to you, it's like that. You know, there's always something, always new questions, always new angle, always another horizon. And of course, therefore, always failure. How wonderful.